This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
There's tremendous profit, there's tremendous wealth being created by these workers, but those corporations are not going to share it with those workers unless they're forced to. And that's why these workers are using a combination of media, political, legal pressure, and strikes to try to change it.
We have to leave it there, but we certainly won't. We'll continue to cover this story. Josh Idelson, thank you so much as well. To our guest in Kansas City, to Terrence Wise. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tune in to Plugged In every first and third Fridays from 10 p.m. to midnight with host DJ Tronic. Tronic does a live mix in the studio featuring the latest in house, techno, tech house, breaks, dubstep, and more. Tronic also has guest DJs in the studio and often talks about upcoming parties, club nights, and more. That's Plugged In every first and third Fridays at 10 p.m. only on KBOO Portland.
Pickathon is an innovative music experience happening from Friday, August 2nd through Sunday, August 4th, just outside of Portland at the beautiful Pendarvis Farm. This one-of-a-kind weekend of music, food, and community features performing artists Sharon Van Etten, The Devil Makes Three, Sally Ford and The Sound Outside, The Foghorn String Band, and many, many more. Information about tickets, camping, and other performers can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is now 5:01 p.m. and you are tuned into KBOO Portland, also at 91.9 in Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 in Philomath and Corvallis. And coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, which has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-231-5588 or cstpdx.com. Coming up right now, the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon veterans picket outside a company involved with contractor KBR to challenge the company's refusal to compensate the vets for injuries received in Iraq.
We'll look at the conviction of a Goldman Sachs executive for misleading investors.
A new report confirms the U.S. military's practice of double-tap drone strikes that target rescuers and media.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 2nd, 2013. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Ren Green. A federal jury has convicted former Goldman Sachs trader Fabrice Touré of civil securities fraud. Touré engaged in the practice of trading packages of people's mortgages, called collateralized debt obligations, to clients knowing they were going to fail, and then collecting even more when they did fail in an elaborate hedge fund scheme. It is not likely Touré will face jail time. For more, KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Dean Baker, who heads the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C.
What are some of the consequences that Fabrice Touré could face as a result of being found liable for misleading investors?
Well, these are civil charges. They aren't criminal, so he's not risking going to jail. But these could mean very large fines. He could be prohibited from being involved in basically the rest of his life in trading in his business. And, you know, I don't know what his assets are, but he certainly could be fined to the extent that basically he loses everything he has. So he can't be very happy about this outcome.
Is there a possibility of criminal charges coming against Tor?
I think probably not. My guess, and I have to say here, I'm not an expert on the law. My guess, though, is that if there were criminal issues, they would have had to have already brought it, because this dates back to actions taken in 2006, 2007. So the statute of limitations almost certainly would have passed on any criminal charges.
Explain to our listeners what abacus is and how it was used in this instance.
Abacus is what was called a synthetic collateralized debt obligation. And what it means by that, a collateralized debt obligation, the non-synthetic type, involves putting together a number of mortgage-backed securities or parts of mortgage-backed securities into one big debt instrument. That's what collateralized debt obligation is. It could often be fairly complex. Now, synthetic collateralized debt obligations take this a step further, because what it means is they're not literally taking ownership. It's in effect a bet. What you're doing is betting on a pool of mortgage-backed securities. If you and I were going to say, oh, you know, I think Apple's going to go up, and you go, no, I think Apple's going to go down, and we just place a bet on it. So go, okay, I'll bet you $100. So we don't actually buy the stock. We're simply betting on the movement. That's in effect what he did. He put together this synthetic collateralized debt obligation called abacus, and he was the one who worked in putting it together. John Paulson, the famous hedge fund manager, was the person who helped design it with the idea that it would lose money. And then Torre, what he was charged with and convicted of, was that he pushed this to buyers with the idea that this was a good investment for them.
So going forward, what protections can be put in place to keep people from enduring this kind of treatment from the financial services industry?
You know, unfortunately, I don't think many of the changes in Dodd-Frank are really going to go that far. One of the measures that I thought was very good, and I'll confess I played a little role in this, ended up being gutted, basically was just removed. Senator Al Franken from Minnesota had an amendment to the bill that passed overwhelmingly, got 65 votes in the Senate, so bipartisan support, it wasn't even close, that would have taken out the role of the issuer, the bank, in picking the bond rating agency. Well, what the Franken Amendment did, very simple, it just said that if you're Goldman Sachs or Citigroup and you want to issue a mortgage-backed security and you want it rated, you don't call Moody's, you call the Securities and Exchange Commission. And then the Securities and Exchange Commission will call Moody's or Standard & Poor's or whoever it might be. And what that does is it removes the incentive for Moody's to lie about the issue. What had happened, it was just classic Washington. The industry lobbied them intensely. They put in dozens of statements as to how this would be so complicated. So this is something, I'm not going to say that had that passed, had that gotten in there, that would stop everything. But boy, this is a really simple way to have a big impact. Congress didn't go in that direction. You know, we've really done very little to reform the financial system, which I just think is really, you know, tragic, because, you know, the country has been through a horrible experience in large part because we had an out-of-control financial system, and it's still pretty much out of control. The big banks are bigger than ever because we had a number of mergers during the crisis that, you know, at other times they might have been stopped or at least delayed or qualified, you know, have some sell-offs of divisions, but that didn't happen. So if you look at the big banks, you know, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan, I'm sorry, also includes Bear Stearns. They merged with the Cucovia, several large mergers that other times wouldn't have happened. So, you know, the big banks are bigger than ever. They're as profitable as ever, and they're doing a lot of the same things. You know, so it's very discouraging in that sense that, you know, we had this crisis where you would have thought, you know, one outcome was a total reorganization of the financial industry and downsizing it and getting back towards its proper purpose. And that just hasn't happened.
Dean Baker, founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
Forest fires in Douglas County in southern Oregon have forced evacuation of 105 people from their homes. 45 residents are being allowed back, but have been warned to be on guard in case the fire changes direction. A group of fires has consumed more than 44 square miles of forest. Many residents in southern Oregon towns, including Medford and Grants Pass, are leaving for the coast to escape the low air quality generated by the fires. One firefighter lost his life when a falling tree landed on him earlier this week. Currently, 4,000 firefighters are battling the numerous blazes around the state as Oregon marks the midpoint of its annual fire season.
In a follow-up to last night's report on the ongoing tar sands oil spill in Alberta, Canada, today KBOO News spoke with journalist Thomas Stackpole. Stackpole writes for Mother Jones and has been following the tar sands leak since it began 10 weeks ago.
Most of the tar sands extraction that's been getting coverage is tar sands mining. You know, it's anything above 80 meters. You basically dig a hole in the ground, and then you process the mixture of bitumen, which is sort of the technical name for the tar sand. And you extract that from clay and sand and whatever else is there, and you can process that into, you know, asphalt or oil or whatever you want to use it for. That accounts for about 20% of Canada's tar sands. The other 80% you get by injecting steam into the ground. And then there's two major processes, but both of them involve, you know, you inject high volumes of high-pressure steam into the ground. It softens the bitumen, and then you can extract it through wells, much in the way that you would traditional oil. So at this site, what you're dealing with is, you know, you have a series of well pads. Some of them are new, some of them are old. So the claims that are being made by the company is that there was an old, defunct well that had been capped, and somehow the casing failed, and, you know, the bitumen that they would normally be extracting found new paths to the surface. So it's interesting because you really don't hear as much about this process, but it's really the major way that tar sands are actually being pulled out of the ground. A lot of people are wondering what's going on under the ground, and that's where we don't really know. So obviously the things that you're worried about you know, contamination of aquifers, you're worried about, you know, is this site going to be destroyed? I mean that's really the worry. With the, you know, other oil spills, you're basically dealing with what's on the ground, but because this is coming up in the way that it is, you know, you're just dealing with a whole different set of problems.
Writes for Mother Jones magazine, where he just published the article, Alberta Tar Sands Spill is Slowing, but Not Stopping.
The E. coli bacteria has been in the news today, with an outbreak in a Vancouver lake and a recall of ground beef across the country. Officials closed Kleinland Park in Vancouver, Washington, to swimmers because of elevated levels of E. coli. Salmon Creek Regional Park and water features remain open. In Kansas, National Beef Packing Company has recalled 22,000 pounds of beef that could be contaminated with E. coli. Locally, the retailer Hagen's has recalled beef sold under the Nature Source label and produced July 18th with a use-by date of August 7th. The beef was sold in Hagen's stores in Snohomish and Oregon City, as well as top food and drug stores in Olympia, Woodinville, and Grays Harbor, Washington. More information on the beef recall can be found at nationalbeef.com.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. On tonight's show, we engage in a conversation about the racial harassment African-American men in our community are daily faced with. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland area is sunny, with a high of 83 tomorrow and a high of 90 on Sunday. Be sure to tune in tomorrow morning from 9 a.m. to noon for a live broadcast from the Pickathon Music Festival at Pendarvis Farm.
Long distance runner. what you standing there for.
It's 5:14. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
We Americans are now pretty clear on who makes up the 1%, the wealthiest elites who feel entitled to profit at the expense of us 99%ers. But who the heck are the 10%ers? According to pollsters at Gallup, a mere 10% of Americans today have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in Congress. That's the lowest rating ever, not only for our nation's august legislative body, but for any institution in America. Gallup reports that public trust in lawmakers has tumbled all the way down to dead last among our nation's major establishment organizations, ranking even lower than the greedheads of big business and fluffheads of TV news. Of course, that's really no surprise, especially given the know-nothings who control the do-nothing nuthouse that claims to be our House of Representatives. Hailing from perversely gerrymandered districts, most of them get elected by an extremist fringe and low-turnout, no-contest races, then come to Washington. Not to govern for the common good, but to prance about in ideological dances designed to titillate the faithful fringe. Thus, we have the ceaseless spectacle of a House that won't even consider passing a jobs program, a future-minded green energy initiative, or even an urgently needed bill to repair and expand America's dangerously deteriorating infrastructure. But, in a buffoonish and totally fruitless political stunt, they have voted again and again, 37 times so far, to repeal Obamacare, all without offering any health care alternative to replace it. This is Jim Hightower saying, so the surprise is not the public's deep distrust of this Congress, but that 10% say they have faith in it. Who in the world are those people? I'm guessing staff members, family dependents, lobbyists, and of course, the unhinged fringe that foisted this bunch on us.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
A new law in Mississippi will require underage girls who give birth in the state to either name the father of the child or provide a sample of their umbilical cord blood for DNA sampling. The bill will impact girls under 16 and was promoted by Republican state legislatures as a way to prosecute men who engage in statutory rape. But attorneys and other legal experts in Mississippi say that this is a very poor way to prosecute rape cases. At the same time, it violates the medical privacy of the mother, father, and baby. One judge who deals with child custody cases in four of Mississippi's poorest counties said that in most cases, it is middle school boys that are getting middle school girls pregnant, not grown men. And the director of the Women's Fund of Mississippi said the bill is a solution looking for a problem, adding that it is easier for politicians to talk about protecting young women than it is for them to talk about adequate sexual education, access to contraception, and problems of poverty and education. The cord blood law was promoted by a group advocating abstinence and opposed to sex education for teens. Its main sponsor is Republican State Representative Andy Gibson, who argues that umbilical cord blood is discarded after birth, which makes it eligible for DNA sampling under a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling. In that ruling, the court said that DNA left on objects, such as saliva on a disposable cup, can be tested as evidence in a criminal case. But legislators opposed to the new law say that it will lead to fishing expeditions for teen fathers and will undermine existing laws that address the problem of statutory rape.
The U.S. government has closed an investigation into the possible massacre of thousands of Afghan fighters in 2001 without releasing any of the findings of its investigation. The men who died were Taliban fighters who surrendered to the U.S.-allied Northern Alliance and gave up their weapons. They were then allegedly loaded into trucks without ventilation to be transported to a U.S.-run prison camp. Many died on the way. Irish filmmaker Jamie Duran describes what eyewitnesses told him when he traveled to Afghanistan to research the incident.
As the containers were opened, the full extent of the carnage became apparent. One soldier, who has since fled from Afghanistan, describes the scene in an interview with a Pakistani newspaper.
I shall never forget the sensation as long as I live. It was the most revolting and the most powerful stench you could ever imagine. a mixture of feces, urine, blood, vomit, and rotting flesh. It was a smell to make you forget all other smells you ever experienced in your life.
For 10 days, the Red Cross tried to get access, but were refused. They were told that they couldn't enter because American soldiers were working inside. Witnesses speak of U.S. soldiers searching the dead for identification before insisting that the Afghans remove the bodies from the prison. The Pentagon, however, will not comment.
The group Physicians for Human Rights has pushed for years for an investigation of the Dasht-e-Leili massacre. Last month, they received a notice from the White House that they would look into the 2001 incident. But just 1 month later, Obama administration officials say that they have closed the investigation and refused to release any of the findings. Former Bush administration officials who were involved in the initial U.S. response to Dasht-e-Leili told ProPublica that they had not been contacted for a new inquiry. For more, we go to Susanna Serkin, Director of International Policy for Physicians for Human Rights, about this week's announcement by the Obama administration.
Physicians for Human Rights and other human rights organizations have been calling for a thorough investigation into these apparent deaths, which, because they would have constituted a war crime. When people surrender to fighting forces, there are laws that require the proper treatment of these prisoners. And they are in the full custody of those to whom they surrendered, in this case, the United States military and the Northern Alliance of Afghanistan. And we've been calling for this investigation for all of these years because we don't really know who knew about this crime, who was actually responsible for the conditions as these trucks crossed the desert. We know from some eyewitnesses, survivors, that reported that gunshots were fired into the trucks, killing some of the prisoners while they were being transported. And we have been asking what the U.S. forces knew, what responsibilities they took when this surrender happened, whether they watched these prisoners being loaded onto the trucks, whether they were at the site when the dead bodies were dumped into this grave, which is now known as the Dasht-e-Leili site near the Shebargan prison in northern Afghanistan. We also found via the New York Times in 2009 that at least three independent federal investigations were impeded, investigations by the Department of Defense, by the State Department, and the FBI in the United States during the Bush administration. These investigations were essentially shut down. And so in 2009, we asked publicly that the Obama administration look into, you know, why were these investigations shut down and what were they revealing. And unfortunately, this past week, we learned via the investigative reporting enterprise ProPublica and CNN News that the Obama administration had, quote, conducted its investigation, unquote, and found that the U.S. was not involved, period. And we believe that this does not at all respond to the many questions that we have had over the years about this atrocity and what appears to have been a massive crime of war in the context of the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001.
That was Susanna Serkin with Physicians for Human Rights, speaking about the U.S. government's failure to investigate the apparent massacre of up to 3,000 surrendering Taliban fighters in Dasht-e-Leili in 2001.
A new investigation by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in the U.K. has found that several U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan deliberately targeted rescuers in what is known as a double-tap strike. In a double-tap, drones strike a location once, then strike it again minutes later when people come to care for the dead and wounded. The findings are based on interviews with eyewitnesses and data from Pakistani and international human rights groups. The revelations come the same week U.S. officials are meeting with the leaders of the countries losing the most civilians to drone strikes, Pakistan and Yemen. In these meetings, our officials are hoping to determine the future of so-called counterterrorism collaboration with those nations. President Obama said today after these meetings that he hopes to end the drone strikes very soon, but did not give a specific timeline for when that might happen. In the meantime, civilians in the targeted areas say that they fear for their lives whenever they hear the buzzing of a U.S. drone overhead. From Washington, D.C., Free Speech Radio News reporter Alice Olstein has more.
The report found that U.S. drone strikes targeted rescuers at least five times in Pakistan last summer, once during a strike on a mosque. The report's publication coincides with Secretary of State John Kerry's trip to Pakistan this week, where he met with Foreign Minister Sartaj Aziz to officially resume high-level negotiations over security issues. At a press conference Thursday, Aziz called the drone strikes counterproductive and a violation of our sovereignty. Kerry responded,
I would simply remind all of our friends that somebody like an al-Qaeda leader like al-Zawahiri is violating the sovereignty of this country. And when they attack people in mosques and blow up people in villages and in marketplaces, they are violating the sovereignty of the country.
But many who have visited the region say many civilians on the ground also regard U.S. drone strikes as terrorism. Robert Naiman with the organization Just Foreign Policy participated in a delegation to Pakistan last year, where he met with parents who had lost children in drone strikes, as well as those organizing for a less militarized society.
What struck me in particular when I was there is people who are otherwise very pro-U.S., people who identify with the United States, empathize with the United States, hate al-Qaeda, say, why are you doing this to our country? Why are you bombing our country? So there's a tremendous sense of bitterness and even betrayal about this policy among the kind of people who would otherwise be very friendly to the United States.
Naiman went on another delegation this summer to meet with drone strike survivors in Yemen.
We asked all of them, have you received any kind of compensation for members of your family to be killed? And they all said, no, we haven't received any compensation. In fact, nobody even came to talk to us and asked us what happened. It's terrible enough to lose your family member and have somebody wounded in a U.S. drone strike. But for there to be no accountability whatsoever, no investigation, no compensation, no apology, nothing, this really adds to the sense of violation.
Despite this growing sentiment in Yemen against the presence of U.S. forces, Yemeni Prime Minister Hadi came to Washington this week to meet with President Obama at the White House. After the meeting, the two leaders told reporters they'd continue a, quote, strong counterterrorism partnership going forward. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Oregon veterans contaminated with sodium dichromate at the Karmat Ali Water Treatment Plant in Iraq picketed today outside the headquarters of Associated Oregon Industries in Salem. For more on this story, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with the lawyer for the veterans, David Sugarman.
Just to give a little bit of background, what happened at Karmat Ali and what was the ruling then in the case that the veterans brought?
At Karmat Ali, the defense contractor KBR had a contract under the Restore Iraqi Oil Project. They were rebuilding infrastructure, and included within that was a water treatment plant for oil extraction. The water treatment plant was heavily contaminated with sodium dichromate. That's the Aaron Brockovich chemical. Very toxic. Oregon Army National Guard veterans at the time were serving there. They provided security to KBR. KBR knew or should have known about this contamination. They did nothing, and they left our troops in this chemical hazard. Many are sick. The Oregon jury heard all the evidence in October
and concluded that KBR had acted negligently and that KBR had also acted recklessly, and assessed the damages for the first 12 of these veterans at a total of $85 million. Some of that was to compensate them, and some of it was to punish KBR for its misconduct.
Has any of that money actually gotten into the hands of the veterans at this point?
Not a dime. The case is on appeal. KBR is continuing to fight and refusing to accept responsibility. They have appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and in the process of that appeal, that's where they asked Associated Organ Industries to get involved. We think that's wrong.
And how did KBR involve the Associated Organ Industries?
We're not exactly sure. We're not privy to those discussions. We have been asked to approve Associated Organ Industries' entry into the case as a friend of the court, or what in legal language is an amicus. But exactly how that happened, what was the nature of the discussion, we don't know. And we have not yet seen Associated Organ Industries filing.
What are some of the effects that the veterans have been facing in the decades since 2003?
There have been a number of health effects, and they've ranged from temporary things like bloody noses and rashes to more serious health problems of asthma, upper gastrointestinal problems like reflux and GERD, and very bad coughs, loss of lung function. There have been, in the broader cohort, there have been deaths from cancer. All of these veterans are at risk for future cancer as well, and that carries with it, that uncertainty carries with it a lot of emotional baggage.
Is there any response, or do you expect any response from Associated Organ Industries to the picket?
Not aware of any, and we'll be carefully following and really interested in what they have to say.
Well, thanks very much. I've been speaking with Attorney David Sugarman, one of the representatives of a number of Oregon Guard soldiers who served at Karmat Ali treatment plant in Iraq and were affected by contaminants there in 2003. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kristen Yount and Robin Ryan. The producer and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. Our engineer is Ian Gadbury. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey commemorate the 68th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, with guests from a special event planned for Tuesday in Portland. At 9 on the Old Mill Variety Hour, Peter Bratzis talks about how capitalist-social relations have given rise to economic man. Alan Weider talks about current politics in South Africa and his new book on Ruth First and Joe Slovo. And Jeff Shantz discusses especifismo, a widely successful approach to anarchist organizing in South America. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, post-Fukushima food monitoring and how gender matters in the atomic age. At 11 on Health Watch, the guest is Dr. Ed Gibbs, one of the few Oregon practitioners licensed in chiropractic, naturopathic, and Chinese medicine. They'll talk about natural home remedies. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, the guest is Matt Samet, author of Death Grip, A Climber's Escape from Benzo Madness. He'll talk about his journey of recovery from anxiety, panic, and anxiety drug addiction. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support of KBOO Radio. If you're not a member yet, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today to become one.
And stay tuned now for media analysis from Counterspin.
Followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, a conversation about the racial harassment African-American men in our community are faced with daily. Good night, Ren.
Happy Friday, Liam.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the verdict in the trial of Bradley Manning came in, and so much of the corporate media finally covered the trial. Manning was found not guilty of aiding the enemy, which was taken as good news. But what else should concern press freedom advocates? We'll talk with Trevor Timm of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Also on Counterspin today, over the express disapproval of the city's residents, Michigan's Republican governor appointed an emergency manager to run the city of Detroit, with the power to declare bankruptcy and void union contracts. Some say it's a way to save Detroit from an economic crisis, but others see an anti-democratic maneuver to favor Detroit's creditors over its workers. We'll hear from sociologist and journalist Darwin Bond Graham about that. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
So the TV networks that took next to no interest in the trial of Army whistleblower Bradley Manning showed up to hear the verdict. But some of the reporters mischaracterized the very leaks that are at the heart of this story. On the July 30th edition of NBC Nightly News, reporter Jim Mikliszewski discussed the video of a 2007 helicopter attack in Iraq, the one WikiLeaks released as the collateral murder video.
In a pre-trial statement to the court, Manning admitted he leaked this classified video of an Apache helicopter attack in Iraq that killed a number of insurgents and two innocent civilians.
But that's not what the video in question actually shows. There are three strikes documented. The first is on a group of men, ostensibly because one has what appears to be a weapon. The second attack was launched on a car that arrived at the scene to assist a wounded Reuters journalist. The driver of that car was killed, and his two children were injured. The third strike was a Hellfire missile that was fired into a building. It is unknown who was killed in that attack. One reporter affiliated with WikiLeaks claimed to have met the owner of the building, who says several members of his family were killed. So where did Mikliszewski get this idea that it was an attack on mostly insurgents? Well, that was the Pentagon's cover story before the video was released. But NBC's Pentagon stenographer is still sticking with that official story. Oh, and at the close of the report, anchor Brian Williams noted that the Manning trial was a widely watched case. Not on NBC, it wasn't.
A lot of folks would give a lot to get themselves and their ideas into the New York Times. But for some people anyway, it seems all they need to give is a call. A story in the July 30th edition headlined, "Despite Gains, Leader of U.S. Forces in Afghanistan Says Troops Must Stay," included this eye-opener. quote, in an interview on Sunday that he had requested, General Dunford, 58, sought to counter an abundance of disheartening news recently about the war and to make a case for why American troops need to stay in Afghanistan after the NATO combat mission ends next year, close quote. And make that case Dunford did in a piece built around what the paper calls his pitch, with hardly a challenge and a deal of commiseration over the difficulties he faces being in charge. The Times says a steady drumbeat of bad news has forced General Dunford to turn his attention to the home front in an effort to counter the spreading perception that the war is a failed enterprise. Well, this story was obviously part of that effort, and all he needed to do to use the Times to make it was to pick up a phone.
The announcement of a White House effort to bring Palestinian and Israeli government officials together for talks led to a lot of, hey, we've been here before, media coverage. Pessimism is to be expected, but we'd hope that reporters could avoid some of the same old problems that have plagued Mideast coverage in the past. The July 31st USA Today could not. One of the most contentious issues is the status of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, colonies that are considered to be illegal under international law. But the newspaper referred to them instead as land in the West Bank, quote, where tens of thousands of Jews have lived for decades in cities and towns known as Israeli settlements, close quote. That makes it sound as if Palestinians are trying to remove Israeli cities. The paper does bring up the legal status of the settlements, but not by citing the overwhelming international consensus or the UN Security Council resolutions or the Geneva Conventions. Instead, the paper reports that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, quote, said he considers settlements illegal, close quote. Whatever one thinks about the chances of a diplomatic breakthrough here, it'd be nice if media outlets covering the story would learn to get these facts straight.
Sometimes a headline says it all, like one from the July 24th New York Times. Some Democrats look to push party away from center. Well, the elevation of an ideal center is corporate media's old faithful, with partisanship, implying disagreement or strongly held views, as its evil opposite. The problem is that the center doesn't mean what you might assume, especially in the context of the political views of the U.S. public. And when journalists call for Democrats to move to the center, they invariably mean they should move to the right. In this article, readers are told, issues related to banks, entitlements, and the rights of consumers are at issue, with some liberals arguing that Democrats, quote, must shift away from the center-left consensus, close quote. The first issue is lowering the interest rate on student loans, with the implication that that would be a step away from the center, except it's a step supported by two-thirds of respondents in a June poll. The Times talks about Democrats who resist Obama's plans to cut Social Security and Medicare. This, too, is a move away from the center, though that would be news to the overwhelming majority of Americans who want to maintain those programs. Then there's a plan to restore Glass-Steagall limits on the banking industry, something Senator Elizabeth Warren is proposing as part of her challenge to what the paper calls the, quote, centrist consensus on high finance, close quote. But what's centrist about allowing big banks to get even bigger? Recent polls, cited by the Washington Post's Ezra Klein, among others, show that, in reality, regulating the banks is really popular. Even the idea of breaking up the big banks draws upwards of 60% support. Just keep that in mind as you hear pundits celebrate the center. Their definition is probably not yours, or Merriam-Webster's for that matter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Media outlets that had mostly tuned out the trial of Army whistleblower Bradley Manning came back to hear the verdict on July 30th, when Manning was found guilty on 19 counts related to the documents he shared with WikiLeaks. The sentencing phase of the trial will continue over the next several weeks, possibly. Joining us now to talk about that verdict, though, and what it could mean for whistleblowers, journalists, and really everyone else, is Trevor Tim. He is a co-founder and the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Welcome to Counterspin, Trevor Tim.
Well, thanks for having me.
There was a sense of relief almost after the verdict was announced because the government did not prevail in this most controversial aspect of their case against Manning. aiding the enemy. One TV report said that he had dodged a bullet. Before we get to the other aspects of the government case, which are of serious concern, remind us what the government was attempting with that aiding the enemy charge and why that was of so much concern to so many people.
Basically, what their argument was even though Manning never had the intent to aid the enemy, his sole intent was to inform the public, which even the prosecution admit, and even though there was no harm that could be proven, that no harm to national security or the United States, the government was arguing because this information ended up on the Internet and Al-Qaeda has an Internet connection, then Manning should have had reason to believe he could have been aiding the enemy by releasing this information. So, you know, obviously this has extraordinary reach if he was ever convicted. You know, when you think about all of the information that the New York Times, the Washington Post publishes that is potentially classified information, or just it doesn't even need to be classified information as far as the aiding the enemy statute's written. You know, Bob Woodward, of course, one of the most famous journalists in America, talks to the nation's top generals in the military. And oftentimes they give him classified information. And Osama bin Laden's been known to read his books. So by this standard, pretty much every source about Woodward's is aiding the enemy. And this would have just had huge implications on future whistleblowers and how journalism is conducted going forth. So it was a good thing that the judge found Manning not guilty on this charge. But the other charges still are quite disturbing.
A guilty verdict on aiding the enemy would have been worse, of course. But one of the pieces that you wrote, you said that there are still plenty to be concerned with here, even if we set this aside for now. Tell us about one part of the case here against Manning, something called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which was also, in the way it was implemented here, rather extraordinary.
Right. So Computer Fraud and Abuse Act has been in the news in the last year because it was the law that was used, unjustly used, to go after the activist and computer engineer Aaron Swartz, who later tragically killed himself. And it's a law that has extraordinary broad reach. But actually, there's one section that's never been used in the CFA, and they used it against Bradley Manning. It's Section A1. And what it is basically just the Espionage Act copied and pasted into a different statute, and basically with the phrase, with a computer added. So if you leak classified information, and the way you get this classified information is by going on a government computer to